honestly, right? Iran supports the liberation of Palestine on so many levels, culturally, politically, militarily, and the International Quds Day is an expression of that very support. It's a call to come together to reiterate support for Palestinian self-determination, liberation, and to oppose Zionism. And so this is an event that basically promotes decolonization, right? It promotes values that people associate with human rights, you know, self-determination, liberation. And Palestinians have been living under Israeli occupation since 1948. And this unchecked brutality, I mean, that would be bad enough anywhere, but the fact it's taking place in such a holy city, in Al-Quds itself, it really shows how much contempt and disdain the Israelis have towards the local Palestinian population. And it's impossible to look at this and not feel compassion. And so that's why Al-Quds Day is very important for the Muslim and the Arab world, the Ummah. And every year, there are parades to mark this occasion in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iran, in Palestine. And while Quds Day is certainly something that's predominantly celebrated and observed in the countries of the axis of resistance, it has grown tremendously in popularity and spread all over the world. So just in the last few years alone, you've had Quds Day marches in London, in Toronto, in Berlin, in Chicago, in Cape Town. And that shows you the meaning behind Al-Quds Day. You know, this is something that really resonates with people worldwide, because when people understand what Palestinians are going through, what Zionism means, then they begin to rally behind this cause, behind the Palestinians, and support their national liberation. So Quds Day is a strong and potent expression of that, of what it means to stand with the oppressed and against the oppressor. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
I spoke earlier to Batul Subeiti. She's an energy engineer and political analyst that's based in London in the UK. And she's written for numerous outlets such as the Tehran Times, Al Mayadeen, and Press TV. She attended this year's Quds Day March in London and told me about her experiences there and why she decided to turn out.
The establishment of Al-Quds Day, it centralized the Palestinian cause as the cause in which all the people of the world should unite. And so Palestine represents that focal point of unity, not just between the Muslims themselves, but all the justice seekers of the world. Imam Khomeini said that the destinies of the oppressed nations needs to be determined. It's a day in which we need to be discussing the solutions for Palestinian liberation. And ultimately, you see this happening in Al-Quds State, right? You see it through the chants. You see it through the nature of the speeches that are given, which they don't hide away from the reality on the ground. They don't hide away from the fact that we shouldn't be pacifists in the face of aggression, and that the only way to actually liberate Palestine is, if we're talking on the ground, it's not through slogans of, you know, we need to sanction European, for example, nations that are complicit, right, when they are literally the ones arming them. But it's no, you have to force that change. You have to structurally enact that change on the ground such that you cause harm to the interests of Israel, to the point where it will consider actually foregoing this occupation, or you jeopardize the interests of America more so, to the point where it will consider foregoing sustaining Israel. And so these kinds of chants are raised, you know, the slogan of armed struggle and armed resistance. And because of that, you know, you have a lot of counter demonstrations, usually huge hefty efforts by even the government to try and ban this march, right? Under the title that they raise concepts of resistance. And I mean, this was also in light of the fact that they prescribed the Resistance of Lebanon as a terrorist organization, the political wing, in 2019. Hence, they're using that tactic to therefore criminalize people coming out on the streets chanting for the liberation of Palestine and being realistic about it. And that's the crucial point that I want to make here, is they are realistic when they're saying only armed struggle and armed resistance will lead to liberation. nothing else in that reality matters, then we have the case study of South Lebanon and how that was achieved. And it seems like that case study is almost never spoken about because it's so powerful and because of the ramifications that it has.
Now, Hezbollah Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, he usually gives a speech on Quds Day. And just to underscore again the importance of Quds Day, when Nasrallah gives the speech, this is one of the most important speeches of the year, right? This is something that people look forward to. And this year he said something very, very interesting. He said that the axis of resistance, meaning the countries that resist Western imperialism and Zionism, like Iran, like Syria, like Yemen, Lebanon, Palestine, they're not just the axis of resistance, but the axis of Al-Quds. What did you think of his statement? Do you think that victory is closer than ever? Do you think that as a whole, not just the Palestinian resistance itself, the axis of resistance, but people's consciousness globally is at a different stage than it used to be before? Are their eyes open to what's happening in Al-Quds and in the Middle East and West Asia?
Oppression is unsustainable, right? Because oppression is not sustainable, it is bound to end, right? It can't sustain itself because there reaches a breaking point. And I think we've at least history has seen that with every case of every arrogant tyrant and every oppressor, their time has come to an end. Again, the reason that Al-Quds is being put forward, I think, and is being centralized and is being made to be the axis of all kinds of oppression, because Al-Quds in many ways alludes to, you can argue, the biggest shame that has ever occurred in humanity occurred in Palestine because of the magnitude of the oppression. The final point that you made in terms of people's consciousness waking up, 110%, and that has certainly been helped with the tools that we have, which is why cyber warfare and cyber activism is so important and why the leader of the resistance himself mentions that. He literally says, go out on your keyboards, type what you need to type, raise the message, normalize concepts. The battle, before the battle is had on the field, it's a battle of the minds and the hearts, right? No one will fight for a cause unless they truly believe it and they've internalized it. And that should be our job.
You know, just to contrast this, the Quds Day that we are talking about, which was created in support of Palestine, it represents support for national liberation, for self-determination, opposition to colonialism and Zionism. Meanwhile, Israel's so-called Jerusalem Day celebrates an illegal invasion, annexation, and military occupation of a holy city. Now, between these two, which do you think the West has tried to ban? The one calling for liberation, for equality, for human rights, or the one that celebrates illegal occupation and annexation? Now, of course, you can guess, there have been many attempts in the West to ban Quds Day marches in support of Palestinians because the Israeli lobby and Israel's allies don't want people to find out about their crimes and don't want support for Palestinians to grow. And so in 2021, Berlin banned the annual Quds Day march. You've had petitions in the UK as well trying to outlaw it. And of course, many hit pieces and smear pieces in the media trying to paint it as some sort of terrorist sympathizer or a Jew-hating event. All sorts of nasty things just to distract and change the subject away from Palestinian self-determination.
So in terms of the attempts to ban the march, the Home Office received several letters. This was even prior to 2019. I think it was 2018, when a man named Darren Osborne, who's a far-right radical fascist in the UK, he claimed prior to the march that he wanted to actually go into the march and run some protesters over, right? And so rather than doing that in the march, he then directed his efforts to Finsbury Park Mosque. For some logistical reasons, I think it didn't work out for him. But I'm saying that's the extent to which they see the threat of it. And the establishment did nothing in order to protect the protesters. I literally mean nothing. When you go to the march, you see how even the Met Police, like the police in the UK, the way that they treat even the protesters, for example, with contempt, right? And the way that they, for example, come close to them, they try to ask them questions. And it's like, rather than protecting them, right, you feel like they're doing the opposite, right? You see them stationed across the side where there are the Zionists trying to ultimately protect them. And it's no surprise, to be honest, when this is a systemic issue, which comes from the top, Now, obviously, their efforts to criminalize the protest hasn't been successful because I think they also fear the huge backlash that will come as a result of that. I think they should know by now that if they try to criminalize it, it won't stop people coming out on the streets, and that might cause them greater injury. I mean, how many people are they willing to arrest? 5,000 people on the streets? I don't think so.
Now, the attempts to ban Khulis Day are rooted in the same smear tactics that you usually see, right? Anyone who criticizes Israel and expresses support for Palestinians is labeled an anti-Semite, which A, is very confusing because Palestinians and Arabs are themselves Semites who speak a Semitic language. And B, this is a protest against Zionism, not against Judaism. Judaism is a religion that dates back thousands of years. Meanwhile, Zionism is a political ideology that was created in Europe in the late 19th century. And C, there are Jews who come to participate in the Quds Day marches. This is a clip right here of Orthodox Jews burning the Israeli flag at a Quds Day march. So are you going to come now and accuse them of being anti-Semites as well? Now, Batul raises a great point because she says, why should we entertain these attacks in the first place? People defending Palestinians themselves don't have anything to explain. And weaponizing their struggle is a very disingenuous thing to do. The only ones that need to do any explaining and be held accountable are the perpetrators of occupation and genocide.
So the whole argument of anti-Semitism, I mean, the way that I put it, and very simply, it's like comparing apples and oranges, honestly. And I think the more that we start to kind of justify that we're not anti-Semitic, I feel like that's playing into the issue, right? Because it's such a contradiction in the way that it came about. I mean, the antagonists of the Zionists during the early 20th century were the Jews themselves. Zionism began as a Christian project before it was a Jewish project, and it was the evangelicals who were the Jew-hating, if you like. The way that they justified it is, you know, if we want to precipitate the second coming of the Messiah, that means the resurrection of the dead, and the Jews, either they become Christians or go to hell, right? That was their philosophy behind it. And so it's the last thing that they care about is really and truly facilitating this kind of Zionist dream. It's actually Jew hatred that takes them in that direction. I mean, the only reason that I'm saying this is just to show the inherent hypocrisy, the inherent contradiction, and the inherent weaponization of using another people's suffering as a political tool. That is what we need to be doing. That is what we need to be calling out. It's like, how dare you do that? How dare you weaponize an entire faith, right? What do you think the people of the world are now starting or will start to do if they look towards an entity like Israel that's claiming to be Jew, right? That is using the name of Judaism as a cover, right? In the same way that, for example, Daesh used the name of Islam. I mean, one of the reasons that the West gave prominent rise to Daesh is to obviously hit the line of the resistance front, right? But the line of the resistance front, right, was spearheaded by Iran, which is a Shia nation. So they consider Daesh to be the best candidate to fight that version of Islam that's a threat to them. The point that I want to make is, in terms of the Jews themselves, we need to, you know, speak about how this actually might cause them injury, right? The moment that Israel gets associated with Judaism and people see it from that lens, is wrong, because people will start to think that is Judaism when that clearly isn't, right? Those people that are simple-minded and can't see beyond the narrative. And ultimately, that's also to prove the point that they don't care. Like, they don't care about Jewish suffering, right? They're just weaponizing it.
And so on this Quds Day, no matter the form, many people, you know, they're coming out, they're hoping, they're praying for the liberation of Al-Quds, the eternal holy city and capital of Palestine. And they hope to see the Palestinian people free, healthy, and happy. And, you know, the fight against colonialism, fighting for national liberation, fighting on behalf or on the side of the oppressed, it's a marathon, right? It's a long-term effort, and it requires stamina and drive and resilience and resolve. And resistance can take many forms, right? Some people resist on the battlefield. Others resist with their words, with their ideas. And as they say, the pen is mightier than the sword. Now, with that said, this right here, this is the last episode of the communique of season one. I know the subject matter, I know the things that we cover are not always the happiest and the brightest in nature, but nevertheless, it's been a pleasure for me to navigate all of these complex issues with you, from Palestine to Yemen to Syria to Lebanon to the Belt and Road Initiative, the elections in Venezuela, the elections in Syria, in Iran, in the United States, covering the Julian Assange case on the ground, covering the Iran nuclear deal on the ground, bringing you all of this original reporting to you right here on a weekly basis. Unquestionably, it's a huge honor and privilege for me not just to host the communique, but to have helped create and produce it and be given this platform to promote the voices of the oppressed, to counter the imperialist corporate mainstream media, and to hopefully make a difference in the world. And while it seems like goodbye, don't worry, it's not, because we'll be right back right here after just a short break, and I really hope to see you all soon for season 2, inshallah. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
This is
For a Better Life.
For a Better Life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are welcome to For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. We are going to talk about some of the benefits of fasting and, of course, fasting in general. We did discuss this in the previous episode, but in this episode, we are going to further elaborate on the reasons or on the purposes of fasting. Dear brothers and sisters, if we can turn down a delicious meal and refreshing drink when we are hungry and thirsty, then we can strengthen our willpower to overcome other desires as well. In the month of Ramadan, we are supposed to abstain from eating and drinking. And when we exercise, keep restraining ourselves from food and drink, then we can also strengthen our willpower to overcome other desires, other, you know, attractions. For this reason, the Prophet told young men who could not get married to fast in order to control their natural urges. Of course, fasting is highly instrumental in enabling the individual to prevent from falling into certain sins. For example, when a person is overwhelmed by the sexual instinct and he fears that he might fall into a sin, the only and the most effective way is to observe fast. As-sawmu junnatun min an-nar. And of course, fasting should also be a means of developing control over our anger. It's not only about controlling our sexual desires, our natural urges. True strength is in the ability of a person to control his or her mind and behavior while they are being provoked to anger. For this reason, we should not argue or respond to the bad words of other people. We should not engage in any kind of altercation. Fasting is, in fact, a means for compassion for the poor and gratitude for the favors of Allah. When we feel the pain of hunger, we have to remember that many people in the world, many people out in the open, go hungry without choosing to do so. It's not in their choice to stay hungry. And of course, they remain hungry. We, by fasting, remember that there are hungry people who suffer from a lack of food, from the scarcity of food. They don't have enough to eat. And we should, of course, empathize with their pain and act within our capabilities to help them. And we should reach out to them once we understand what poverty actually means and what it means to have no food to eat. So we have to reach out to those people who are poor, who have nothing to eat and nothing to drink. Reflecting on the situation of those who are in need will also generate gratitude and contentment for the blessings in our lives, of course. Let's have a break. We will be back.
We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different
different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
The ultimate end, the ultimate goal of fasting is to develop virtues, as we discussed in the previous episode, perform good deeds, and control our sinful passions, and then get proximity to Allah, get closeness and nearness to Allah. And of course, when we get nearness to Allah, we achieve prosperity, we achieve happiness, and we live a better life. Of course, a better life, if we want to live it, is achieved by developing virtues, by performing good deeds, by maintaining patience and virtue in our life, by controlling our desires, our whims, our passions, which always tend to lead us away from the right path, which always tend to lead us astray, you know. So that's when we achieve paradise. That's when we can ensure a better life for ourselves, not only in this world, but also in the other world. Brothers and sisters, when we speak about the wisdom of prescribing fast, why Allah, for example, prescribed fasting, so we should understand that fasting is a means towards devoutness. This is because if a person abstains from certain lawful necessities such as food and drink for the sake of pleasing Allah and out of fear of His wrath and punishment, then it becomes easy upon him to abstain from what is prohibited. There are many things which are prohibited, which are attractive, and of course, fasting enables him to abstain from those prohibited things. Fasting leads to sincerity. No one except Allah knows the truth of a person's fast. It is possible for a person to refrain from fasting without anybody's knowledge. And yet nothing prevents a person from refraining from fasting except Allah. Allah knows, Allah has knowledge of what we do in secret. There's nothing that keeps our activities hidden to Allah. So Allah knows whether we are fasting, and if we are fasting, what we are fasting. Are we fasting for Allah? Are we fasting in compliance with the command of Allah, with the order of Allah? Are we fasting to please Allah?
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
A person who fasts and who observes fasting with the intention of his pleasure, with the intention of pleasing Allah, of course, is endowed with sincerity. And he will definitely achieve sincerity at the end of the day. As I said, fasting is a means to gratitude. This is because by abstaining from such things as food and drink and the rest of the lawful things, lawful sensuous desires especially, during the fasting hours, the full extent of these blessings becomes manifest. And of course, it finally allows the person to express his gratitude for all these great divine bounties for which Allah does not ask for recompense, you know. The heart starts overflowing with mercy, compassion, and sympathy for the poor, the needy, and the destitute. The heart empathizes with the poor, with the needy, with the destitute, who have nothing to eat and nothing to survive. There are millions and millions of poor people across the world. And fasting should have its impact on the rich people, especially to realize that it's their duty to reach out to the poor people. And of course, fasting is also a means to ward off satanic insinuations, satanic temptations, by cultivating patience to endure hunger and thirst. My time is running out. May Allah bless you in this month of Ramadan, and may you gain the reward of fasting and the reward of keeping vigil in the month of Ramadan, staying up and worshipping Allah in these great nights of Ramadan. Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, he
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here today. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a question which is kind of pertinent to us on this day. Because as you know, this is the last day of Ramadan, the end of Ramadan, and basically tomorrow is, the day of Eid for a lot of people. So the question we're going to be asking today is this: who should be happy on Eid? You know, everybody is happy on Eid, right? No matter who it is, right? Regardless of whether the person fasts and he's happy that he doesn't have to fast to tomorrow, right? Or not, he didn't really, wasn't really able to fast, and he wasn't really spiritually successful in this month. He didn't do any ibadat or anything. But at the same time, he's happy because, you know, it's Eid tomorrow, it's a holiday, or for whatever reason, you know, he's happy on Eid. But the question we want to ask you today here is this. Is this right? Is this proper? Should everybody, you know, celebrate Eid? Should everybody be happy on Eid or not? Fortunately, we have certain traditions which kind of allude to the answer to this question. And, you know, we can benefit from these hadiths and these tradition narrations and kind of figure out the solution to this problem and this question. Imam Ali alayhi salam said the following regarding one of the festivals, one of the a'yad, one of the Eids. He said, verily, it is only a festival, it is only an Eid for someone whose fasts Allah has accepted and whose prayers He has not acknowledged. And whose prayers He has acknowledged. Meaning if somebody's fasts have been accepted by God and his prayers have been acknowledged by God, then for this person, this is really a celebration and a festival and an Eid, right? The natural conclusion and concomitant or, you know, corollary of this is that, well, if somebody, let's say that somebody, every day, you know, that he performs acts of worship, those acts of worship are accepted by God and you know, God acknowledges them. So technically that day should be an Eid for this person. In fact, Imam Ali, alayhi salam, he says yes. And he affirms and he accepts this. Because in the continuation of this tradition, Imam Ali says, and every day in which we do not disobey Allah is in fact a day of celebration and an Eid. Right? Here it's possible for the answer to our question that we've just arrived at through this tradition to kind of open the door to another question. Somebody might say here, well, that's true, but how do we know whether our... we don't really know whether our actions have been accepted by God or not. Who really has the surety whether to say that, you know, his acts of ibadat, his worship, his prayers have been accepted and acknowledged by God or not? Nobody knows. Therefore, consequently, we shouldn't really be too happy on Eid because we're not really, should we be happy or not? We don't really know. Well, the answer to this question is, actually, this is true. We should never really be totally sure. Because we're not really sure whether our acts of worship have been accepted or not, we kind of have but we do have the hope in it. So we should kind of be sort of happy and at the same time, vigilant at the same time, and not so happy at the same time as well. Right? So we shouldn't be 100% happy because we're not really sure about it or not. But at the same time, we should have hope and raja, as they say in Arabic, with respect to these acts of worship. And so there should be a taint of happiness in us on this day. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. Well, we were looking at who should celebrate Eid on the day of the festival of Eid in the light of the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
A talk with remarkable people.
It's a tragedy, virtually impossible for an American to see on television, to read books, to see films about the Middle East that are not colored politically by this conflict, in which the Arabs almost always play the role of terrorists and violent people and irrational and so on and so forth. The only thing they understand is the language of force. This is the principle here, that unless you give them a bloody nose, they won't understand. We can't talk reason with them.
I mean, even with the former Secretary of State John Kerry saying you're going to become an apartheid state, for which he was condemned by so many and he was quickly shut up. He said to Israel, if you keep this way, you're going to be an apartheid state. One American said this, John Kerry. He was immediately shut up. Because Israel is the exception. It always goes back to the Holocaust. There is an empirical reality of the Jewish life. They did have a Holocaust. Okay, but there were many other genocides. It was an Armenian genocide nobody ever speaks about. But they have effectively put this forth. There are living images that are always put across. There are museums all over the place. The Holocaust is something that was horrible that happened and that everybody condemned it. But the Zionists find it very useful in order to legitimize Israel. Second, you have the rise of the religious right. And both in Israel, where they say God gave them the land, and the evangelicals here, and evangelicals that were in the United Kingdom who actually wanted to see a Jewish state in order to get rid of Jews and to bring about the end times. At a certain point, the British officialdom began also to think in terms of having a Jewish state that would be a client state in their own imperial thrust into the Middle East. And so they tended to favor it. It was very clear that the British wanted to give somebody else's land to a foreign ideological group because it seemed at that time to serve British interests. So the British gave to the Zionists Palestine, even though Palestine was under a League of Nations mandate. The British had put in the mandate the promise to the Zionists, but at the same time, in Article 11, I believe, of the mandate, it called for the British to prepare the existing population for nationhood, for statehood. They just gave the land away, even though the majority of the population were the indigenous Palestinian people.
Interplay between British domestic and imperial considerations, Jewish Zionist lobbyists and Christian Zionist prophetic politics would lead to the Balfour Declaration, which promised a Jewish homeland in Palestine. Then an imperial world power, Britain, gave sanction for the first time to the Zionist campaign for possession of Palestine.
Professor Chomsky, I would like to start with a word of Edward Said talking about you in 1975 in the Palestinian Review. He says, "There are men whose humanity is armed with learning with an indefatigable energy for seeking out uncomfortable truths and little known because deliberately buried facts. So I wanted to start with this saying of Edward Said, whom you know very well.
Yes, we were a mutual admiration society.
Yes. In the text of your lecture given at Columbia at the memorial of Edward Said, December 2009, you say, "I think the greatest singular achievement of Said as literary critic has been to put imperialism at the center of Western civilization. There is an almost remarkable tendency to not mention imperialism as shaping the contours of Western civilization. In literary criticism and historical writing, there are two times, before Orientalism and after Orientalism. And my question is, in the light of Orientalism, can you explain what is imperialism?"
There are many efforts to define the term. I think we all know pretty much what it means. It means the exerting of the power of one state over the people and society of others. It can take many forms, direct conquest, harsh sanctions, current U.S. mode of imperialism. In the case in question, there has been basically a thousand-year war of the North against the global South, borrowing the phrase of the eminent historian of the Middle East, William Polk. And as he points out, the war against the global South is mostly the war against the Muslim South. This war has taken many forms. The Muslim South has sought many ways to resist: accommodation, imitation, direct resistance, conciliation. Nothing has worked. The final stage, the current stage, is a kind of jihadism. In fact, Polk's great work on the subject is called Crusaders and Jihadis, reviewing this long history. But we've now, just about every imaginable form has been used: direct aggression, occupation over and over. Yesterday we heard a new stage in the direct support for direct aggression and occupation. The U.S. government's announcement that it now will violate the judgment of the International Court of Justice, which declared all settlements, all Israeli settlements in the occupied territories, to be illegal. Even the U.S. Justice Bergenthal, gave his accord to this in a separate statement. Yesterday, the Secretary of State declared that the United States no longer abides by that. So here's a case of aggression and occupation, which is officially recognized by the United States, instead of merely supporting it as it's been doing all along and blocking efforts to negotiate a settlement. So aggression and violation are one form of imperialism. Brutal sanctions are another form. There's only one country in the world that is powerful enough to impose sanctions, which it does freely. That's the United States. Sanctions issued by the United States, in fact, apply not just to the state that sanctioned, but to every other country. So when the U.S. declares sanctions against Iran in order to try to destroy its economy, undermine its regime, European countries don't agree, but they have no choice but to accept U.S. orders. The U.S. essentially runs the international financial system, and countries that disobey the orders of the Godfather will be duly punished.
Then we can say that imperialism is always a domination on other people, other countries?
That's the way we use the term. So it takes the history of the United States, which is a striking case. The United States, the founding fathers described their goals of taking over control of what's now the national territory, in fact, the entire continent, as a form of imperialism. They didn't refrain from using the term. There are other forms of imperialism, the British Empire, the French Empire, the Spanish Empire. Hitler's conquests were a form of imperialism. The Russian Empire was another one. It all involves one or another form of domination, sometimes combined with much harsher crimes, even aims at total extermination.
You say, and I quote you, settler colonialism commonly the most vicious form of imperial conquest. Can you give me an explanation of your saying, especially in the context of Palestine-Israel?
Settler colonialism is indeed quite an extreme form of imperial domination. Settler colonialism not only dominates the nations that are conquered and repressed, but it actually replaces their population. It involves ethnic cleansing, extermination, replacement of the populations by the new settlers who come in and essentially take over. So the United States is a extreme case of settler colonialism. Of course, there were many millions of native people here who were driven out, exterminated. The new colonists took over their lands. Another case is Israel's entire existence. It was a form of settler colonialism. It essentially the initial Zionist, some call it invasion, whatever term you want to use, the emigration to the former Palestine. There were, I think, possibilities for accommodation and integration, but they didn't last very long. But the formation of Israel in 1948, the conquests that took place that year left Jewish domination of most of the country, about half the country. The other half was taken over by Jordan in a tacit agreement with the Zionist movement. The Palestinian population was mostly expelled, many killed. Some remained in the West Bank, in the Jordanian area, a few in the Jewish area. Then in 1967, the outcome of the war was that Israel took over new territories, new Palestinian territories, the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and has since been carrying out extensive further settler colonialism, establishing an extensive settlement structure. In the West Bank, Israel has moved in hundreds of thousands of settlers. It's expanded what used to be Jerusalem to about five times its size, taking in Palestinian villages. Policy has been pretty clear since about 1970, but to try to establish what will be a greater Israel, with the settled areas integrated into Israel by vast infrastructure projects. The remaining Palestinian population is segregated into small enclaves. There's almost probably 160, 170 of them now. But the Israeli settler colonial project is a striking case now, again, underway before our eyes.
Professor Chomsky, I heard you on Democracy Now, and I want to ask you about the role of Great Britain in the implementation of the Zionist project in historical Palestine.
Well, after the First World War, the former Ottoman Empire, which included Palestine, was essentially taken over by Britain and France, and they carved it up in a secret agreement, Sykes-Picot Agreement, for their own interests, not giving any attention and concern to the interests of the local population. That was irrelevant. France took Lebanon and Syria. Britain took what's now Palestine and Iraq, and created what were called mandates under the League of Nations, which in theory were supposed to lead to independence and some degree of local sovereignty, but in practice meant developed in accord with the interests of the dominant powers. Britain authorized the establishment of what was called a Jewish national home. There was some wording about preserving the rights of the native population, indigenous population, but that had the usual meaning in imperial history. In fact, Lord Balfour himself, author of the Balfour Declaration, separately stated that the interests of the indigenous population really didn't amount to much. It was somewhat varied, but effectively it supported the Zionist immigration project. The mid-1930s, there was an Arab uprising protesting the British government control and policies and the Zionist immigration. The British put down the revolt very brutally, laid the basis for the Israeli conquest that took place in 1948. So the British rule was, there are more ugly cases in history, but it was pretty unpleasant, to put it pretty mildly, and quite supportive of the basic Zionist immigration project. Incidentally, it's not that the opinions of the population were unknown. They were quite well known. Woodrow Wilson, the U.S. president, sent a commission, the King Crane Commission, to do a careful study of the attitudes and opinions of the local population. And not surprisingly, they were overwhelmingly opposed to the European immigration, the Jewish immigration. Their concerns are reported in a detailed study, but no one paid any attention to them.
What are the reasons, Professor Chomsky, for Europe and USA to back up Israel?
It's kind of a mixed story. Take the U.S., which is the strongest supporter. U.S. government attitudes towards Israel were kind of sympathetic, but not overly supportive in the 1950s and 1960s. In fact, in 1956, when Israel, jointly with Britain and France, invaded Egypt, Israel took over the Sinai, they tried to overthrow Nasser. President Eisenhower simply ordered them out. After 1967, the war in which, the major 1967 war, U.S. relations with Israel changed dramatically. At that point, Israel became a highly favored client state. There's a reason. Israel had performed a major service to the United States and to its Saudi Arabian ally in 1967. There was a conflict going on, actually a literal war going on, between Saudi Arabia and Egypt, representing two different varieties of the Islamic world. Egypt was the center of a kind of secular nationalism, Saudi Arabia was, of course, the center of radical Islamism. The United States, very much like Britain before it, tended strongly to support radical Islam in opposition to secular nationalism, which was considered much more dangerous. Israel destroyed the centers of secular nationalism, a major gift to the United States that firmed up the relationship between the United States and Israel. All the way back to 1948, the U.S. military, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had been impressed with Israel's military prowess and considered it to be a potential military ally of the United States in the region. That increased through the years, and Israel became recognized to be a strategic asset, as it's called, a base for American power.
Why Israel persist in this 21st century to continue its politics of colonization and its politics of destruction?
It's continuing because it can easily get away with it. It's like asking why any other power tries to extend its power and wealth. Now, they can do it because the United States provides strong support. Europe provides tacit support. The Trump administration is, of course, extreme in this case. And as long as that continues, it's hard to imagine that Israel won't continue to try to maximize its power and wealth as long as it's authorized to do so. Like any other power, they'll find all kind of pretexts to justify it. That's normal. But the basic facts are pretty simple.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitani lanur rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim wa bihi nasta'in. Welcome dear listeners to IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program For Humanity, and we are listening to the segment Hollywood Conditioning of the Subconscious Mind and Extermination of Human Rights. We were talking about how the media influences our mind and how the media overloads our brain with information that when our brain has free time, it gets busy in processing this information. This is Sheikh Ali Himani from Qom. In the last episode, we discussed that how about doing a short experiment, that going and offering prayers or offering our salat after watching some media content, and trying another way where we avoid all media content, rather pay attention to Quran, pay attention to dua, do wudu, recite one page of Quran or even five lines of Quran, and then go and offer our salat, and then see the difference, the impact that media has caused on our brain and how it has overloaded. Let me help you understand a very simple concept here. Imagine I have a computer with me. And in this computer, I have a Word file. Now, in this Word file, if I copy and paste one page of information, it will quickly copy and paste that one page of information. It won't delay in processing this information and showing it on your screen. But now imagine if I copy and paste 200 pages of information on my Word file, which also has audio in it, which also